No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
I guess that means we have to start. Hello, everybody. This is the Ask the Paizo GMs panel, where we talk a little bit about GMing. You get to ask us questions about GMing. You know, if you want detailed critiques, we're probably not going to do that, but, you know, who knows? You might get us going. Basically anything you want to ask us, that's great. Let me introduce myself, and I'll let the other folks introduce them. My name's Stephen Reddy McFarlane. I'm the senior designer at Paizo.
I'm Leo Glass. I'm an editor at Paizo.
I'm James Case. I'm an editor at Paizo.
All right. So GMing, it's fun. Everybody loves it. That's why, you know, there's always more GMs than players. It's not very time consuming at all. And players are never a pain. So what kind of questions do you have? None. This is going to be short. Yeah.
So I just had my first TPK completely on accident, to be perfectly honest. But it kind of has like derailed.
Oh, you'll get better.
I was going to say congratulations.
So what tips do you have for basically reintroducing new characters to a story that they no longer have?
Oh, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. I can start. You guys have any ideas before I start babbling on?
Well, I mean, go and I'll see what I can add. But I do have a little.
I mean, the death in RPGs is always kind of a traumatic experience. People get very attached to their characters, right? A TPK is just something that, you know, quite frankly, some people never get over. If you can find a way to sort of shift that trauma on its head, right? Unreliable narration is a very good way to do it. Not to say, oh, and you all woke up and it was a bad dream. But having one of my favorite tropes is to have basically almost a deal with the devil, where somebody evil brings you back to do something specific for them. In return, right? And maybe they don't even know that at first. They might seem benevolent and everything else. And basically being able to work their way past the TPK in some kind of way. You could also just be nice, I'm kind of mean, actually have the forces of good bring them back for some kind of reason. You could also have a generational thing where it's like 20 years later, you know, friends and family of the people who died are picking up the mantle and have made their way into whatever great quest or you know, petty squabble or whatever that the campaign has led to at that point. Those are some of my favorite tricks to bringing sort of the campaign back, even though all of the original players are dead.
I think it's a very real-world idea that death has to be the end as well, right? And sort of what Stephen was saying, like, if your whole party dies, why not lead them on an adventure through the Boneyard trying to find their way back, right? Like, why not? Why does that have to be the stopping point? Let's continue the story. That's a great opportunity for maybe an extra planar adventure, right? Or something that keeps going. In addition to that, you know, it is a really monumental event. And because of that, you could give the characters sort of new life, right? By being, this is where these heroes died, and maybe a new party comes in, they hear about that. Like, you can build up the anticipation of the NPCs that killed them, right? Like, make those monsters, oh, did you hear that adventuring company died, you know, to them? And, like, build up a new opportunity. Maybe they investigate the deaths of the previous party, or tie it in somehow so the players are still like, oh, wow, we died, but we changed the story. You know, it's like, if you ever played Oregon Trail, people stop at the headstones and read them for a reason, right? And so that's sort of stuck with me, because those headstones, I was always like, oh, I remember that time that snake got me. That was cool. So I think if you can build that into your game, you know, look for ways that death can still be meaningful to the story.
Yeah. I agree with that a lot. I don't particularly like resurrection in a lot of, just as a general rule, because I'm like, in a world where people can get resurrected, how do people still, you know, die a lot? So kind of, depending on the mood of your story, though, you can always pick it up with characters who are related to the original characters. So the story is the same, even though the characters are not. And sort of depending on your scope, it could be family members, it could be people who they were, like, you know, in a street crew with. It could be any of those things. But it allows you to continue the story past. And kind of like what Leo was saying, you can bring back the notion of the original characters in, like, maybe one of them, like, discovers a letter that the original PC left behind and that can, like, story hook you in. So they can still remain as a presence in the story, and if later, you know, perhaps they get brought back, you can figure out what happens to the character at that point. Good job on your TPK.
Do it again and again and again.
Yeah. How did they react?
Yeah.
I think about halfway through, everyone was like, there's no way out of this, is there? It's like, oh, that's up to you guys. And they decided that they were going to go down fighting, and, you know, breath spells are dangerous.
Yeah.
That's always thrilling when there's no way out of this, is there?
But that sounds like a really good opportunity to have a good, like, narrative and dramatic moment where if whatever they were doing, they realize they can't get out of there, at least can, like, go out in a blaze of glory. That sounds like a lot of fun, and that actually brings you into, like, a nice, that's a big moment that perhaps whatever the next group of characters who these players end up playing that could maybe hear about this event happening, right?
So I run a game that's primarily, well, is all online, and I guess the question I have is, we don't use webcams or anything like that, so it's really hard to know whether the players are digging something I'm saying or not, because a lot of times I'm talking about, you know, and then I know that you can tell that some people are distracted because home is distracting and that kind of thing. Do you have any tips to try to, help gauge that or to just keep them interested in it? I try to make sure that I'm using, you know, good art for the maps and the tokens and things, but yeah. I mean, there's only so much you can do to force them to stay at the keyboard and right. Headphones on.
Yeah.
Leo, you run a lot of remotes. So.
Yeah, so I'm running a Starfinder game right now where we are just using Google Draw, like, for all the maps. I'm just dropping it in. Everybody's going in there. And then because, honestly, some folks had some computer constraints that they couldn't use some of the other types of things that are out there. And so I was like, okay, cool. We'll just run this really, really simple, really easy. And we just meet in a Discord channel, right? And I totally get what you're saying because I have a player who's got, like, cats and dogs running all over them during the session. I've got one who has a young child. And so you'll hear, oh, I have to go put the baby down or whatever. And it's like, that's cool. I get that you have lives, but I just want to be your focal point for 3 hours. Focus on me, you know? And it's like, oh, wait a minute. Hold on. They're adults, right? And so... to that point, I would say energy is important, right? So try to make those first 30 seconds. It's just like I used to work in the university setting with professors, and I'd always say, you know, your first 15 seconds really define how your lecture is going to go the rest of the way. While recaps are cool, if you can start off with an energetic sort of NPC that's going to get them right back into the setting, I feel like that's going to pull them in a little bit more. If things start to get a little bit off, hey, let's just take a break and then reboot and do another really awesome 15 seconds and let that launch back into the game. And then just be patient with the fact that you can't, there's no body language or kinesics that's going to help you now. You, like, literally, if people are falling asleep at your table, you could tell, right? But when you're sitting there, when you're listening, you know, you just don't have that advantage. So I think just being patient with, okay, I might feel like the world is burning and they're not having fun right now and they're disengaged, but maybe they're just processing. Maybe they're just thinking, you know, kind of just listen and actually gauge whether or not you're right about that.
As a side onto that, what you can do, and you can do this at a live table as well, is you can shift some of the prompts to the characters. You could be like, oh, well, what, you know, you see the eagle outside the window. What do you do about it? Or, like, is there something you want to do? And to that extent, I was always happy at, like, having players recap the previous session because it kind of gets them in the mood of they're talking and they're acting, that kind of thing.
Yeah, preparation is probably key, right? You probably really want to run a fairly tight game to keep the attention on there. When your attention starts to waver because you're shuffling around or trying to put something together, their attention is going to waver as well. And then, you know, it could just be a downward spiral, and next thing you know, everybody's taking potty breaks and chasing cats.
So we have a question from Twitch.
Yeah.
Lori7x3 asks, I have a hard time introducing new PCs in an adventure path like Strange Aeons that doesn't expect the PCs to die to tell the story. What should I do?
doesn't expect the PCs to die to tell the story.
Yeah, could you actually reread that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I got that. I don't know if I clocked the last. Yeah. Can we phone a friend?
Yeah.
I have a hard time. I think that they're asking, how should they be introducing a PC in the middle of an adventure path, especially maybe after one of the PCs died?
Oh,
okay.
I'm not sure if that's what they're doing.
Well, you seem trustworthy. No.
Yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent, I've always found, like, how does the party start adventuring together, or how do you introduce a new PC to be... Well, it's nice if you can do that in a way that makes sense in the game's narrative. I've always found it to be kind of a little bit of a useful suspension of disbelief. I'm like, there are five human beings at this table. There will be, you know, that many PCs here, and we're just like... We don't want to wait around forever to introduce the character, so just, like, you come into the woods, and they've been captured by goblins, and then you free them, and they go with you. Or, you know, you get stranded together in some sort of location, like on an island or a ship, that prevents them from kind of leaving. And then once they've had a couple of engagements together, you have that sense of, like, oh, well, we've saved each other's lives a few times, and then further adventuring is sort of natural, so...
I think I also find that nothing creates a very natural bond like shared conflict. And so if you end up putting the new PC in with the encounter and they're, you know, they're getting roughed up by demons and that's what the PCs see, then they can come, you know, quote unquote, to the rescue. The group can kind of gel together. And then you can start weaving those stories together. And that's usually fairly easy to find an encounter or an event or something like that where the new PC is already sympathetic because they're against the same folks that the other PCs are already fighting against.
Right. You have like a shared antagonist.
Yeah,
so it's,
exactly.
It's pretty easy.
All right, next question. Oh, there's Mr. TPK, it's your turn again.
Completely in the direction. So one of the games I'm running on Roll20 is War of the Ground. And I started really enjoying it. I come from a Call of Cthulhu background, so there's a lot of, you know, discussion. And the whole first section is this massive social combat. But I did find that maintaining 43 different NPCs was really daunting. Do you have tips if you have these mass amounts of NPCs to keep track of everything?
So one of the things that I've done quite a bit, and my players tend to call it the dead board because eventually they all end up dead, is Paizo Adventures are really, mostly if you get the PDFs, you can grab like the images and make little cards. And so I'd have this white erase board and make cards, and then I'd have pictures and the names of the NPCs. And so when I say the NPC to the players and they go, who is that again? They can look at the board and go, oh, it's that guy or it's that lady or whatever. That helps solidify it in the minds of the players, who they're talking to at that time or who exactly that is, mostly week from week when, you know, memory gets a little hazy. Also, using the same consistent miniature for them, if you've got, you know, a large number of NPC miniatures you can have at your disposal, also helps. Talking in funny voices for each one, although that's a lot of funny voices. So those are some of my tricks.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I was just joking with Amanda today how my goblins are always sort of have a Cockney accent, you know, like, hello, I'm a goblin, you know, that sort of thing. And like... But what's nice about that, if is at least, you know, just from an auditory perspective, is it gives them an instant, hey, this NPC is different. Now, I know doing 43 voices and 43, so that's not exactly the answer to your question, but what I'm sort of trying to say is NPC distinction, and so that'll lead into what I do. I actually use index cards as well, but to your question earlier about how do you do that online, right? So I keep kind of a little recipe container sort of thing full of index cards, and it is literally my treasure trove of NPCs in every game I run. And the backside is always their stats, the line side. The front side is just things I want them to, I really want the players always to get. So like if I come up with a clever one-liner in the shower or whatever, right? I'm like, oh, I really want this goblin to insult this PC because I feel like, you know, they'll bite into it. I'll write that down on the front side. Or, you know, is arrogant, you know, doesn't like doing laundry, whatever the...
Hates pickles
with a passion, yeah. Loves slicing dogs. Whatever it is, You know, and write those things. So just every time I've got one, it's like, okay, yes, I've got, you know, 100 cards in that box, but I can quickly focus, if that makes sense. And mechanically, I can also quickly focus. If combat happens, or you know players, sometimes they'll pick fights with NPCs you never thought would happen. And so sometimes I'll just keep a general, like, not necessarily cards, but just like, oh, if they pick a fight with a general fighter NPC, I've got the stats right there that if I need to suddenly graft something, I can. And then to your point about online, I'll also sometimes keep just like a Google Doc or something where I'll number it, so that if I need any other information, I can just refer and keep the NPCs straight that way.
Yeah, especially if you're playing online, it becomes really easy to sort of integrate this, like, you know, player-facing resource there.
Yeah.
Which again, like, I make the players fill it out themselves, because, like, not only does it keep them in, and, you know, if you write stuff down, if you write stuff down yourself, you're more likely to remember it, but it also kind of tells me what the image that the players are getting of this NPC, because I may have conceived of the NPC a certain way, and the players are just getting, like, a totally different image out of it, and in which case I usually just roll with that, because, you know, that's the one that we have going. But the funny voices is, like, a thing, and accents, but really, I think what Leo said best there is, like, creating distinction between them. So that doesn't have to be an accent, although it certainly can be that. But I like to just have, like, a lot of weird and random information for them, like favorite food, or like a tick they do a lot, or anything like that. And so it doesn't have to be a voice for everybody. It could be like twirls his mustache all the time, or something like that, or like nervously taps cane against ground, you know, a lot. So it helps to kind of give them those ticks, because then, especially if they're different kinds of ticks, because then it's not like you're just trying to remember accent and accent. It's like accent and a smell that they always have, or like accent and a behavior they always do, or something.
And to build on that, what's interesting too is sometimes you can just sort of make an NPC more interesting in the way that you define it by the player that it interacts with or judges too, right? So like in my Starfinder game, I have an icon that is recognizable. Like, she basically wanted to be the Amy Schumer of space, was her character concept, right? She wanted to be like a space comedian sort of thing. But it's like, okay, so who recognizes her? And Starfinder also recommends that you have all this currency that's like cred stick, and also just like the currencies of the actual planets they visit, right? And so they got all of this Akatonian, like ingots I was calling them, and all this like coins they couldn't spend. And like, well, how do I spend this money? I want to spend it. I was like, oh, well, you go to the currency exchange. Well, the NPC at the currency exchange I had just done a little bit of an explanation for was pretty inconsequential, but became this major sort of NPC all of a sudden, because I also rolled real quick that they recognized the icon. They like totally like, oh my god, I love every single movie you've ever done, or every Hollywood you've ever done. This is amazing. And just like freaked out. And suddenly there was this other social challenge they had of getting this person to calm down, because all they wanted was their money. You know, and like, and you know, so just be fluid, I guess, enough to be like, okay, I've got 43. Some of them are more important. Some of them are less important. But maybe a less important one can become more important in the minds of your players.
Steal ruthlessly. You find some character on TV that you think is cool, like, you know, grab their social traits or tics or mannerisms and everything. You know, you'll do it so poorly your players won't notice.
we
got Twitch.
Anchor89 asks, where should a new GM that knows nothing about Galarian start in researching and becoming educated on the history and pathos of the world?
Oof. The Inner Sea guy? That's where you, yeah, that's definitely where you want to start, is the Inner Sea Guide. It's got basically overviews of everything, including the religion and whatnot. So, buy that book. Keep it under your bed. Read it every day. Maybe we'll come to your house and quiz you. No, we're not.
I'd also say that you don't need to, you don't actually need to know everything about the history of all of Galarian to run, you know, a campaign. Even if you're running something that's like relatively big in geographic scope, you know, you don't need to know everything about, you know, Arcadia if you're just in this one section of this one town, right? So I would say start with the campaign concept that you have in mind, which you want to run, and just start reading there. You know, because you only need enough to flesh out the world that you are, the focus is currently at.
Yeah.
Right? It can be quite daunting to, I guess, just pick up and have to know everything otherwise. So.
Yeah.
So I'm planning on running a campaign soon that is a murder mystery, where the players play as police officers trying to solve a series of crimes in a major city.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any recommendations for a dungeon master who's not used to running non-combat encounters for making non-combat things seem more interesting?
Well, if you haven't checked it out yet, you'll probably want to check out Ultimate Intrigue. It's mostly got a great section on for intrigue and murder mysteries and stuff like that, spells that will get you in trouble, and how to counter those things. And it's also got a lot of great advice on running exactly those kind of adventures in the GM section. And then it's got a bunch of tools in the spell section that you can sprinkle on into the campaign, because it's got even in the spell section, we tended to have here's a cool intrigue spell and here's its counter later on. So, you know, you've always got a way to thwart it, both you and your players, right? And you can play those games. Start out at low levels, and because with magic in the world, murder mysteries become very, very difficult to run. You got to be pretty clever, and also just, you know, find your favorite mysteries and steal ruthlessly from them as well. Yeah.
The excitement of combat comes not only because you get to, like, shoot lasers out of your fingers, and that's fun, but it's also because there's a risk of failure with everything you do.
Yeah.
And so, like, the reason why, you know, an adventure where you walk from one side of a room to another is not exciting is because, you know, there's no risk of failure. Nothing could really stop you. So if you're running a non-combat encounter, you can still require things like checks if you want to, because they introduce that sense of you're using your character's abilities and you may win or you may succeed. But, like, if there's a higher cost to the outcome, like, if the social encounter, for instance, is, like, you've been apprehended by the town guard because you look like a bad guy who came through, the scope is now pretty high, right? And so you're trying to get out of that. It can still be exciting because, like, you stand a lot to lose if you get mistaken for this guy and then they throw you in jail forever, something like that.
And that's a good point. Like, I'd think about the points of intensity first. You know, I kind of come from a video game design background, and I think about, okay, if I was beat mapping this, how would I want it to escalate? Like, literally as it rises, it needs to be going up and down, right? And with social encounters, you have a challenge of how do you be building that conflict in. And so as you think about this murder mystery, think about a loved one who might freak out and they might have to proverbially talk them off a ledge or from doing something really rash. Or, you know, convince a investigator who has lots of other things going on that they need to pay special focus. Like, think about all the sort of, and maybe it leads to combat, right? Like, I think about, I think it's Bendis's powers. Like, I think about the comics and the good detective stories I've read in those. And it's like, man, that starts with this really interesting negotiation that sort of leads into a fight, but then kind of goes back into more conversation. And so I would think about, okay, what are those really intense moments that are both combat oriented and social, and just list them all out and then think about how you can sprinkle them in.
Hey, Twitch, I hear you have a question.
We have a bit of a follow up from a previous question.
Okay.
Follow up to the introducing new PCs.
Mm-hmm.
It seems the difficulty is not just generically introducing a new PC, but it's the Rather Strange Alien as an example, because in chapters 3 or 4, according to the Twitch chat, there's some very important parts that require some of the original NPCs to still be around.
Yep.
So how do you handle death and replacement of the PC in a situation where the PC needs to be there later?
Well, I'm not hugely familiar with the particulars of that section, but it's always good to get creative. Like, the original PC could possess the new PC for a period of time, at least for those, I mean, which seems like something Strange Aeon should do. And it doesn't even really have to be a physical possession, but could be, you know, almost like the spirit is floating around to be able to, you know, and motivating the new PC. It could be in the familiar. If the adventure absolutely needs some aspect of that that old PC around, there are plenty of fantasy tropes to allow it to be there for at least as long as it needs to be, even, you know, even if it's not truly coming back.
I would also say you can just lie and or ignore the book. Like, if you went to a place that is causing, like, you are not able to tell the story because you're trying to stick to this constraint, then, like, just fudge it, frankly. Like, yeah. If, for instance, whatever it was about that original PC that is required in the story, you can try to find a way to transfer it onto the new PC. So if it could be, like, you know, the heir of house whatever has to be here. Well, the old one died, and now the new PC is the heir. Or if it's something more mystical, you can, you know, many fantasy tropes can come into play where, like, their essence comes into, like, an item or something. But, like, whatever that is, find an excuse to just transfer it onto the new person. Or be like, you need the blessing of whoever, and then that person, like, gives that blessing to you, and now you're the one who holds it. So, yeah.
Don't ever let our books stop you from having fun.
Right. Right.
Go off rails. It's not great. It's a lot of fun, actually. Yes.
So, do you guys have any advice on how to either gently curb a bunch of murder hobos, or at least make the game a little more interesting if you're going to be adding players?
Oh, don't do it gently.
Right. <Yeah. laughs>
Everything they run into is so much more powerful than them that if they try to murder hobo it, they'll get, like, beaten down but not killed very strongly, and then they'll, like, maybe try not to murder so much.
The other thing is, one of the things that I really love to play with is consequences for murder hoboism. Right. Things that, you know, like, oh, that was the prince, and who's after us now? Vengeance is a powerful motivator for, you know, people in the real world. Imagine, you know, a clan of dragons decides, really, you did what? And they're going to find that fun for a while. And then you might be able to kind of get them to at least think about the consequences of their actions, which is usually what you want murder hobos to eventually do. But in order to do that, you have to make interesting, potentially lethal, but always have an escape route, and usually an escape route that they feel mildly uncomfortable with, but is really obvious if they think about it for about 15 minutes, and sort of find a way to transform your game into something that's both murderous and cerebral.
And that's, I think, a good caveat where, like, there are times for murder hoboism, like, and you can throw those opportunities at the PCs to sort of, you know, give them, because, like, people like to play in combat sometimes, you know? And so just, like, there's a bunch of zombies attacking the town tomorrow night. We need somebody to go out and, you know, kill all the zombies. And it's like, this is a good outlet for their, like, psychopathic tendencies.
Right.
You know.
Well, I see that as a great opportunity to subvert tropes and expectations, too. Because it's like, okay, you know, we killed a terrifying monster. What if the terrifying monster had a friend? And not necessarily, like, and they might be expecting vengeance or retribution. What if they come seeking sympathy or consolation? Or, like, and I'm not saying, okay, just guilt your players into feeling bad about what they did, but I think there's opportunities for social exploration there and, like, meaningful role play, right? I tend to be the type that if we're going to have a role play session for 4 hours and just really explore an idea, why not, you know? And what if it's like, well, you know, we were actually, you thought this was just a monster. They were actually key to this really important thing that was going to happen in the world. And now that they're slain, they can't do it. Can you help me with that? Because what else am I going to do? My world is turned upside down because of your actions.
I'm always a little, like, reluctant to, like, even though I just said a little while ago, just, like, make everything stronger than them. I'm always a little reluctant to, like, have the consequence of murder hoboing be more violence coming in, because, like, it feels kind of like you're rewarding the action by, like, giving more of... You're giving them what you don't want them to do to prevent them from doing that thing.
Yeah.
And so, like, that can be kind of tough. So I was...
Escalation.
Yeah. you hit a point at some point. So, like, yeah. Changing the consequence to be one that has consequences but is maybe not one that you can fight your way out of. Like, maybe they get thrown into a jail and then it's just, like, a bunch of really complex puzzles and locks and traps to get out, and you can't, like, sword your way through the magic rune of warding that is blocking the door. So, yeah.
Hey, Twitch, I hear you have a question for us.
I do. Someone's running War for the Crown, and they were wondering if there was any advice about
like in how to handle planar travel,
like,
happening?
I'm assuming that it's getting...
These are very broad questions. Well, like, you start with this, we're running this adventure, but can we have some planar travel advice?
I think it's more tricks, tips, anything that you've learned from having to run it, but things to look out for, pitfalls you might fall into,
just different things like that.
I mean, this kind of goes without saying, but sometimes the simplest things are best. Is make it fun, like, and make it interesting. A lot of times when I've been in games, planar travel comes off as just a plot device when it just happens. But if you actually have to take a weird ship through the astral, or you know, or roam through the boneyards to figure out exactly where you need, you know, the portal where you need to go, those things are always a little bit more exciting. Make the travel itself an adventure. It's through and beyond the pale. Make it fun and interesting. That's my only.
And think about advice. I mean, Planar Adventures, I think, has some sections on this too. But just think about how different everything is in another plane. You know, they get there, and it's like you're even aging differently. You are digesting, and your body is acting differently. Gravity has a different effect on you. Suddenly, there is a force of an alignment. Like, I mean, we have speak with planes in Plane Hoppers, because you could go to the abyss and talk to it if you cast that spell, right? And so there are also planes you go to that are watching you. What is that like? You're in a place that you always have that sense of foreboding about you. I would make things as weird as possible.
It's like honestly. A celestial North Korea.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And make it uncomfortable so that it's either like, okay, we're going to embrace this challenge, again, to your point about conflict. Just dig into that conflict. And then just let them explore it, but continue to throw a little bit more. You don't have to give them everything, every characteristic of the plane when they get there.
Yeah.
Just keep sprinkling a little bit in, ratcheting up that intensity. And if you can ratchet that intensity of being in this otherworldly place at the same time the serious question's going to be called, you're really going to have them engaged as far as... So that would be my recommendation.
I would say try to maintain ties to the previous story. Like, I am actually not a huge fan of planar travel because it just feels like the scope gets so enormous so quickly when you do it. But, like, you don't want to, we caused all these problems on the material plane with this very, like, low-level thing, and now we're, you know, we're off in Nirvana, and now nothing we did on the material plane matters because that's, like, dimensions ago. So you can have, like, PCs or consequences of any kind follow them through so that, like, the story, even though they're in a new setting, that doesn't mean, like, all of a sudden the previous story completely finishes and the new story starts and, like, nothing carries over. So you have, like, a bit of continuity there.
Do you have any advice on running villains with intelligence vastly higher than your own?
Steal from movies. Yeah. yet again, I mean, there are kind of some mechanical tricks you can do it, like little sort of cheats where they, you know, get crazy bonuses for all sorts of things. But, some of the best things is just finding a villain that you think is really smart from some form of media and go, how would that villain look in this guise and this in the city and whatnot? There's this movie that's based on my favorite book, my favorite novel, and it's called The Ninth Gate. And Boris Balkin in there is just, he is just a scene-chewing, always ahead of the protagonist, and, well, until the end, bad guy. And I've probably used him numerous times in many different guises, from, you know, grumpy old dwarves to, you know, twisted celestials, in one way, shape, or form, just because I like the cut of his jib.
I actually find this trope immensely frustrating in everything except tabletops, which is that the villain being smart means that, like, whatever he needs to do to foil the hero's plan, that's just what he's going to do next.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it, in certain, like, especially, like, in movies, because they have, like, a shorter running time, it often feels like the writer is just giving the villain a bunch of get-out-of-jail cards.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I find this more okay in tabletops. I don't know if it's just, like, it feels a little more interactive, but, like, for something where if you have, like, your stereotypical evil wizard, wizards have to pre-prepare their spells. You can kind of loosen up on their prepared spells and just be like, this is what he always has, and, like, just assume that of this list he has resist energy and it's whatever the PCs usually use because he's smart or he's scryed on them or he can plot it out. that kind of thing. So throwing in these kind of contingencies that are, and in a way kind of making them tropier kind of excuses them a bit. Like, we recognize tropes and we're like kind of primed to accept them in a certain way. So if like the heroes have all backed the villain up into a corner, and if he like says something kind of cheesy and like presses a heretofore unexisting switch on the wall that causes him to come out a secret passageway, that's classic. Like, that we accept this as like a trope that can happen, and like I don't have to write down there is a secret trapdoor on the wall. It can just be wherever the villain ends up, that's where the trapdoor is. So lie constantly to your players for the to have the
it's kind of Schrodinger's villain.
The seeming to have the seeming of the villain being really intelligent is just reality warps around him so that he is always right.
It's a lot easier to do if you're writing your own adventures. Than,
for sure.
For 5 years later, the player goes, you know, I read that adventure path that the guy.
There was no trapdoor there.
Yeah.
Never underestimate the power of the clearance section at the bookstore, though. I will say so, and the reason why I say that is because I bought nonfiction books on secret societies, on serial killers, and just reading some of those nonfiction books that people look at sitting on a shelf for years because like, do I really want this on my coffee table? People are going to come over and be like, oh, you're reading about serial killers? And I'm like, please. And how did they evade the FBI? How did they? And then that gives you some clues of like, okay, I'm a kick in the door person, right? Like, I'm not a scheming, megalomaniacal, you know, and it's like,
well, that's
okay,
not the rumor.
Well, then it's working. Then it's working. But being that way, I'm always like, can I just smash it? And I think, to their points, you just have to sort of pretend to not be yourself, which sort of is GMing in the first place, and go, okay. But having some maps, some real-world maps, can definitely help.
Yeah, truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
Read about Ted Kaczynski. That'll give you all you need to know.
Yeah.
You give them false information, and here's the reason why. It's like, well, and you can couch it in a way. It's like, well, here's what people know about this place, and just give them a whole bunch of false information.
So you haven't started playing yet.
No. Okay.
Yeah, and because you know, think about back when other parts of the world were being discovered, and the kind of false information. That's actually the way information travels at first. And so it gives them certain expectations or certain ideas, and then they find out very quickly there's a fun aspect of like, oh, what we knew was wrong. Now we have to go out and discover the things that that are actually here. Turns out there's no sea monsters in the oceans, but
that's what it can be, is like they can get, rather than it being completely false, you can get something where it is, because this is a lot of what happened during like the Age of Sail, is like it's not all the way wrong, but like, you know, reports have been exaggerated or something. So maybe there are no sea monsters, but there are vicious river crabs or something.
Right.
I mean, also, if you haven't started playing, the last time I ran a Pathfinder campaign, it almost derailed because the PCs almost got wiped out by like the normal like crabs on the way to the first time. It was fine. It was
the legend of the crab.
Oh yeah, but the PCs don't need to know like a rubric of every town and stone and city in the New World when they go there. Like, you can just give them kind of a brief outline, and I really liked Stephen's suggestion of like, some people say this, other people say this, and those can be things that you tie into later, you know. So if you say that there's like some, you know, beast who lives on the coast with one glowing eye, that could turn out to be like missing reports of like some lighthouse, and then that lighthouse is the cool dungeon that you're going into. Yeah. And when that happens, the players cannot have this like moment of tie back, and that's kind of a cool thing to going. Yeah. Yes?
I'm about to start running a new adventure path within the next couple weeks, and I have had two players approach me who are expressing interest in joining that campaign. However, those two players do not get along. Mm-hmm. So how do I navigate that situation without telling somebody, like, oh, you can't play with us, or, like, you know, that kind of thing, without playing favorites, pretty much?
Yeah, that's a... It's funny how the GM also comes down to being the kind of, you know, mediator of conflict. talk. I mean, the game needs to, like, whatever game you're playing, you need the buy-in of all the participants, you know, the GM included, to do it. So if they insurmountably cannot get along, then that might be difficult to have them both be at the table. But you should at least put them. It's not your responsibility to resolve this for them. Like, they should, you know, you should say, like, you both have expressed interest. Can you, like, talk to each other, you know, try and figure stuff out?
Yeah, I think my way is not everybody's way, but I think it's very effective. And that's, like, mostly if, did they know that each other wants? Yeah. I'd be all like, well, I'm going to invite this other person too, so you two better work out your shit. And because I'm not going to, you know, if you, I'll kick both of you out if you can't learn how to get along. It's an important adult lesson to learn, is getting along with even people you don't like from time to time, mm-hmm. especially to play a fun game.
And especially, and like, you know, and playing with fewer people, or, you know, finding people who you wouldn't ordinarily play with to fill in the slots if you really want to have more numbers, is better than playing with, like, two people who are actively creating a hostile mood at the table. Because that affects not just those two, it affects everybody. And, you know, like, everybody's busy. We take time out, you know, to do these things.
It's supposed to be fun, right?
This is theoretically, this is fun. So, like, yeah exactly.
Actually, I had something like that. It helps immensely if you're running the game at your house, because social mores won't let two people,
Maybe I'm weird, but I just say roll with it. the reason why
think
I said
of
that,
the
maybe
excitement.
It's my, well, maybe it's my acting background, right? But like, I'm kind of like, well, here's the thing: you're always gonna be like, it's still a drama, it's a game, and it's supposed to be fun. Why not channel that little bit of, you know, animosity and comfortability you have with somebody else, and say to them, look, you can't fight at the table. Like, that will derail the game. That will create it. But I get that you're a little passionate about this person. So can you put that into your role play? Can you? And what happens if you put it into working as a team with that person? And maybe you'll subtly convince them that they like each other because their characters start to work together and like each other, right? Like, Wolverine doesn't have to like Colossus to do a fastball or a cannonball special, right? Like, it's just. I feel like just channel it, let it go. If they can keep it, oh, see, who cares? As long as they're
But boot them all, but boot them out aggressively and immediately if it, like, starts to spill over.
Well, yeah. No, I would never. You know, encourage that. But
yeah. Anybody? Yes.
What's your favorite non-combat challenge to throw at your players, and why?
I recently really liked the idea of, like, games and or. Drinking games and or things that because there was a really cool one in one of the recent Pathfinder adventures. I'm blanking. There's all sorts of cool things in there, and I just sort of like the idea of simple social situations that most people think is fun that sort of corrupt in weird ways and that could have, like, real world consequences, like going to jail or something like that, but also maybe, you know, summoning some terrible thing that you thought you were just drinking out of a cup, tossing coins, you know, in meat or whatever.
The ritual is complete.
Yeah, so, but I guess to me, the intersection of social situations maybe leading into combat or leading into another adventure is what intrigues me right now, but I don't know.
I really like the social combat and ultimate intrigue, which sort of, you know, has this rigmarole of argument and various forms to kind of get a one-up. It takes a little bit to get people to, you got to get the right group to role-play it, but once you get it going, it's a heck of a lot of fun. Mostly if you do it in large parties or at court or something like that, and really kind of draw it out with a lot of interesting folks. I do, and I've written a lot of these encounters, and you'll also see one in the playtest adventure in Red Flags that I wrote as well, is I like writing encounters where you have to interact with weirdos at parties and get information. So that's, I think
dinner
that's
parties.
Probably,
oh man, and
that's
Red
probably
Flags
my favorite.
Is definitely that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I like finding excuses to throw, like, really classic fantasy things in, like, the sense of if you're either exploring or if you're interacting. Like, I had one time when the party the PCs just, they all got cursed, no safe. It was a function of where they were, and I gave them each a slip of paper, and they each had, like, a different thing on it. And one was, like, everything you say must be, like, a lie at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, keeping in, so they each had something like that, and they had to continue to work together for this goal. One was, like, you have been possessed by the villain. You are now the villain. These are your goals. And so that, like, secret knowledge of each player, and of course, the instant you pass out the papers or something, like, the players all know that, like, the game has started, mm-hmm. which I like. Like, they know that we have entered sort of a weird, like, a different mode of play. And if they're all quite different from each other, it leads to something that's, like, not, like, a normal combat. And they're trying to work towards a goal, and, like, that could happen in combat, but that can just as well happen, you know, in some sort of dinner party.
Right? I was going to say, maybe something. I like dinner parties, too, because you just made me think of...
dinner parties are great. You have an excuse to have it. Whatever NPCs you need are there. Like, it's great.
I ran an adventure once where integrated a rival faction invited the PCs to a dinner party to gauge whether or not they should poison them at the end of it. Right? And so I feel like you can have some social interaction there, and they don't even realize they're being tested, so to speak. Go from there.
A dinner party before a gladiatorial tournament where they were each trying to assess
sure.
what the other people at the dinner party might possibly be doing and then be able to plan accordingly.
For Queen and Empire has at least 3 dinner parties.
So dinner parties.
Yeah, dinner parties.
So this has turned into our dinner party.
Panel approved.
Panel approved.
Dinner parties.
Yeah. I think we have time for maybe one.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got the 5 minutes. Yeah.
A little bit more on the macro level.
Yep.
The concept I've been working on is, in effect, two parties have to engage each other.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have 2 separate DMs, how would you handle that?
So you have something like, you have 2 GMs and something like 10 players or something?
5 players.
You're fusing 2 games.
GM MMO, for lack of a better way to explain it.
Mm. Oh, wow.
What do we do for the specials?
Yeah, so
I've been thinking about this a little bit because I've been kind of playing with an idea I have that is like, how could you multi-GM a game, right? And how? And I haven't fleshed a lot of it out yet, but I think the core piece seems to be communication between GMs, right? And so you'd almost have to have, I mean, I kind of see it like you could organize 2 tables that are like sitting side by side. The GMs sit by each other because I think they're going to need to be kind of swapping notes. Yeah. And even be able to be like just, you know, able to kind of pull each other aside. But then I think you also have to think about what you want out of that. Is the joy of it really the PC on PC battle? Are you as GMs trying to lead them into maybe cooperating for some adventure? So you maybe start like it's a Thor Iron Man kind of let's start with a fight and then let's go find Loki kind of thing. But I think you really need to fit because to the players, while it might be kind of exciting, oh yeah, we get to battle other players. I think it might also kind of be like, well, wait, why are we doing this? You know, and is this really that cool? Because player on player attacks always sound really fun until it happens. I don't know if you've ever had it at a table, but it's always kind of like, oh yeah, we killed him because he acted out of his alignment, and we didn't really like that. But now we have a player at the table who doesn't have a character anymore,
and they just flip the table.
Yeah.
And like the player and the player is piloted by like a human being at the table who you have an ongoing social relationship with. So it's one of those things where it's like if my character, you know, gets killed by Leo's character for reasons that are like frustrating or obscure and that don't seem to make sense in character, like for a lot of people, and like actually myself included a little bit, like I'm just like, okay, well Leo effectively took me out of playing the game for a while.
Leo is a jerk.
Leo is a jerk.
Alright.
It wasn't necessarily, it could be combat, but like you say, either collaboration or rather one is eventually the character swapping.
Mm. Oh, sure. Mm. Yeah, so and I mean, that's just setting good expectations with your players. Like, hey, I have this idea. Do you want to try it? What do you think? And maybe even asking, like, how do you think we could pull this off? What do you want to do so that they kind of engage in it?
So one of the things, and I'm not super well-versed in the specials, so please correct me, but I like the idea of things in the specials being, like, the consequences of one party's actions can affect what happens in the other. So, like, if party A, like, works really hard, you know, raising the gate, then party B can go forward and then they do something. But, like, the two parties need to feel like they're having an impact on each other's adventures. Even if, and this doesn't need to be in the same room. They could be, like, on other sides of the castle. They could be on other sides of the planet, you know, each working at the task. But the consequence of, like, what party A does needs to, in real time, like, affect party B. Because then it feels like they're actually adventuring together and they're not just playing two adventures on two tables that happen to be in the same room.
And these work better when they're either cooperative or separately competitive, right? You know, they're both working towards the same goal, and they can see, at least at some point, how they've helped each other with that goal, or they're competing for the same goal and who gets there first.
Which kind of opposite sides of the mountain towards the relic.
Right. Yeah, sure. And when you start messing around with character autonomy, it's like, and all of a sudden, you're Jack the Dwarf. And it's all like, but, you know, unless the players have at least an inkling of that could be possible, you'll get a lot of bad feelings because that's my character. I don't want somebody
like
else's character.
It's like I wanted to play Lydia the Witch, right? And now Jack the Dwarf.
I mean, jumping from party to party.
Yeah, sure.
I think that what Stephen is saying is generally good advice for this sort of thing. Where if you are affecting sort of the meta structure of how this game is thought to be played, I think that works better when you bring that in as like the initial assumption rather than something you add on later. The adventure.
Good question, though.
I think that's all the time. We don't have anything from Twitch, right?
We're good right now.
Okay, we're good.
All right.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much. Great questions. Thanks.
Cool. Yeah,
enjoy the con, everybody.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks.